Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Lauren Gilger. In Valley traffic at this hour, a few accidents for you to watch out for. I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue, also I-10 westbound at the 202, and there's a collision blocking the shoulder I-17 northbound at 7th Avenue. Valley weather for the rest of today, we will stay sunny, looking for a high temperature in the lower 70s. And then for tonight, clear skies, lows in the upper 40s, should be sunny with a high of 72 tomorrow. Currently relative humidity at 38%, 70 degrees at KJZZ.
The Arizona Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that a trial court judge was wrong when he decided a search of a probationer's home without a warrant violated his rights. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports the high court decision means a drug and weapons case against a convicted crack cocaine dealer can be refiled.
More broadly, it means people on probation can't move to exclude evidence seized during many warrantless searches. The case involves the 2013 arrest of a convicted crack cocaine dealer on probation. Police received a tip in 2012 that 36-year-old Christian Adair was again selling cocaine but saw nothing after setting up surveillance. Officers then called the Maricopa County Probation Department, which found crack cocaine, scales, cash, and a gun in a search authorized under Adair's probation terms. Adair's lawyer argued probation officials had no reasonable basis to search, and a Maricopa County Superior Court judge agreed. The Arizona Court of Appeals ruled the trial judge used the wrong standard in determining if the search was reasonable and ordered him to reconsider his ruling using the right standard. The state Supreme Court went further, saying there's clear evidence the search was legal. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The years-long battle between the Tohono O'odham Nation and several gaming tribes over the development of the Desert Diamond Casino in the West Valley may soon be resolved. That's if enough tribes sign off on a set of proposed amendments to the state gaming compact. Governor Doug Ducey and a group of 9 tribal leaders got that process started yesterday by signing a memorandum of understanding to begin formal negotiations. KJZZ's Kerry Young was at the state capitol yesterday for that signing ceremony and joins me now. So, Kerry, what kind of changes can we now expect to see in gaming operations?
Okay, so the important thing to remember is that yesterday was a signing ceremony. It doesn't mean that anything is set in stone yet. It just means negotiations will officially start. But the basics that we're looking at, number one, keno games at each casino will increase from 2 to 4. The number of poker tables casinos can have will also increase. So the state is allowing this in exchange for stricter regulations about exactly where new casinos can be built, with the biggest focus on the Phoenix metro area. If passed, tribes will only be able to build new casinos on land they held in trust before February of 2003. Now, that date is important because that date is just after the time the Tohono O'odham Nation purchased the county island near Glendale, the one where the West Valley Casino is built. So if you look into that further, that means the state does intend to approve the tribe for Class 3 gaming in their new Desert Diamond Casino. That approval is something state officials had been withholding.
So would this essentially end the legal challenges the state has been caught up in against the Tohono O'odham Nation?
If the amendments are approved, it appears so, yes. And while the Tohono O'odham Nation was not at the signing ceremony yesterday, they did release a written statement. Officials said they would consider a compact amendment as long as the language would resolve the outstanding litigation, include Class 3 gaming at its West Valley facility, and includes language regarding no new casinos in the Phoenix area. At the signing ceremony yesterday, I also spoke with Stephen Rowe Lewis. He's the governor of the Gila River Indian Community. That's one of the tribes that had opposed the new West Valley Casino. He said he's glad that they've found a way to put this issue behind them.
We see this as finally, hopefully, dealing with this issue so we can move past it, because all the tribes have kind of been in a holding pattern in regards to how we want to move forward with compact amendments, with potential renegotiating.
And that was Stephen Rowe Lewis, the governor of the Gila River Indian Community. Kerry, can you give us a little bit of history on this whole situation? Because didn't the current compact already limit new casinos near the Phoenix area?
That's a good question, and that's the question that all of these legal challenges surround. And the short answer is actually no. It was something that was assumed would be the case when the compact was signed in 2002. The compact limits how many casinos each tribe can build within their reservation land. So tribes like Gila River and the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, whose borders are near the metro area, had already reached or were close to reaching their limit at the time. What no one anticipated was the Tohono O'odham Nation's purchase of a county island near Glendale that was later taken into trust or essentially turned into their reservation land here.
Okay, but for the most part, isn't gaming on new tribal land prohibited?
The short answer there is yes, but there is a loophole here. One of the exceptions to this law is when the land in question is part of a land settlement, which this is. The tribe was owed several thousand acres in exchange for land in southern Arizona, where their main reservation is located. That was flooded thanks to a dam project, so this was a land exchange.
And so that would seem like a solid argument. So why did challenges, legal and otherwise, keep going?
Well, some say this all went down, especially when the tribes were negotiating the original compact in 2002, that all of this wasn't the most straightforward. In other words, some say the Tohono O'odham Nation knew they were going to build this casino near Glendale, but just didn't disclose it. Former president of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community, Diane Enos, put it this way in an interview with KJZZ last year.
The proposal by the Tohono O'odham Nation's West Valley Casino is a direct violation of the spirit of the compact.
The spirit of the compact is the key here. An interesting fact to note, when the tribe was checking out the exchange land to purchase, they did so using a shell company, which is a company that just exists on paper. Now, that is a common practice in real estate deals. It ensures you don't get price gouged if companies know what you might intend to build there. That's what the Tohono O'odham Nation argues was the reason for this shell company. But in the grand scheme of things, other tribes say that was a convenient excuse.
Okay, before we head down the rabbit hole too far with the legalese in this case, one final question. When do we expect to find out if the proposed amendments are approved?
The governor's office says soon, actually. Officials will begin talks in December already. They say all gaming tribes will have a seat at the table for these discussions. Once they sign off, the last step is the approval from the Interior Department.
KJZZ's Carrie Young with the latest on possible changes to Arizona's gaming compact. And Carrie, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
So we may be on the cusp of changes to the 2002 Gaming Compact, and with me to explain more about what's to come is ASU Law Professor Robert Clinton. Among other things, he specializes in Native American law. Professor, what needs updating in the compact?
Obviously, we now have quite a lot of experience of the state and the tribe cooperating the regulation of gaming. There's probably more regulation in the 2002 compact by the state that is probably necessary. Having the state back off a little bit and leaving the tribal regulators as the primary regulators may make sense. There have been amendments to the 2002 compact that some of the tribes have adopted. It was amended in 2009, so this would be just another set of negotiations to further update. The other thing that you might want to think about is that in 2002, the internet used for gambling was not very common. Whereas internet growth since 2002 and just technological growth since 2002 has been quite impressive, and there might be some room for negotiations over those kinds of questions.
And how bitter has the relationship been between the Tohono O'odham and some of the other tribes because of this Glendale casino? And is that fixable?
I'm not sure how fixable it is. The difficulty with the Glendale casino is that all of the tribes in the 2002 compact agreed to abide by the provisions of Section 20 of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, the federal statute that governs Indian gaming, which basically, with a number of exceptions, prohibits gaming on after-acquired lands, that is, lands acquired after the effective date of that act, which was October 17, 1988, and the TO lands were definitely acquired after that date. There are some exceptions in that section, including one that's critical to the TO casino, which is the settlement of an Indian land claim. And I don't think anybody thought TO had a land claim, so I think everybody thought that there wasn't going to be any expansion in Metro Phoenix. And in fact, Governor Ducey's agreement is designed to reinforce that expectation while permitting TO to actually operate not only as a Class 2 casino, which is the way they're operating now, but perhaps as a Class 3 casino, if they abide by the agreement. So far, they haven't signed on.
Professor, were you surprised that Representative Trent Franks was there? I know he represents the district in Glendale, but he was also someone who had introduced federal legislation related to this. Does this indicate to you that everyone is potentially on board to at least be at the table on this?
Everyone is a big question. I think the answer is, if TO is willing to sign on, it sounds like everybody might be on board. But the fact that Tohono O'odham, in fact, had the governor's proposal for, at least according to the governor's assistant, a couple of weeks, and wasn't there and hadn't signed on, suggests that it perhaps everybody's not on board. We're going to know that on or before December 15th because there's a trial date set on litigation involving that casino in the federal district courts on December 15th. And a lot of what you saw yesterday was an effort to try to come to an amicable settlement, not only with Tohono O'odham over that question, but with all of the affected tribes in the area.
So what's the likelihood at this point, based on what we know and based on negotiations potentially here, that we will not see another new casino, a Native American casino, in the Metro Phoenix area at any point in the near future?
I would have thought it fairly unlikely you would have even seen the Tohono O'odham casino. I'm actually quite surprised they got as far as they did. I think even without the agreement, it was highly unlikely we would see a new casino. With the agreement, if the tribes all sign on, I think there isn't simply not going to be a new casino. That doesn't mean there won't be expansion of existing ones, but there, if the tribes sign on, there simply won't be another one in the Metro Phoenix area.
Robert Clinton is a professor at ASU's O'Connor College of Law.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump had a lot to say about trade deals, from the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership to NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA was signed in 1994, and President-elect Trump has vowed to leave the deal if it's not renegotiated to get a better deal for U.S. workers. But Arizona does about $13 billion in trade with Mexico. So what would renegotiating NAFTA mean for our state's economy? I spoke with Margie Emmerman about this at her office. She's vice president of strategic initiatives at government affairs firm Malera Alvarez. And she spent her career working on Mexico policy in Arizona. And I asked her about NAFTA's effect on Arizona's economy.
When you look at it from a jobs perspective, it's about 90,000 jobs a year. And then if you put in the tourism side of it, you've got about another, 60,000 jobs there. So just strictly from a jobs perspective, it's a huge amount of labor force that we have in the market for trade with Mexico. If you start impacting Mexico's ability to have a robust trade with the United States that then creates jobs on the Mexican side, it's going to limit their ability to be able to come to the state of Arizona from a tourism perspective, and they spend about $7 million a day in Arizona right now. So that goes down, then retail, tourism, restaurants, hotels, all of that decreases. So the net effect will be pretty detrimental to the state of Arizona if that balance of trade and tourism is impacted by any of President-elect Trump's thoughts right now. We are certainly hoping that we can sit down, and what I'm saying is we, the collective trade community, can sit down with him and have him understand that in a globalized economy, you want to have robust trade agreements with as many people as possible. Because if the United States and Arizona being a part of that gets marginalized, then we are going to be taken out of those trade deals. If we're out, then Mexico and Canada and other countries will find other people to trade with because the global economy is not going to stand still.
So it sounds like Arizona would be uniquely affected if NAFTA were to change.
Well, we would be uniquely affected because we have a port of entry that is a gateway. We have maximized that. We have just spent a tremendous amount of dollars improving our infrastructure. The port of entry of Mariposa specifically is now a really competitive, state-of-the-art port of entry. We are positioned to be able to increase our trade because of that. So it would definitely, this is not a good time for that to happen. because finally Arizona has some great assets that we can capitalize on.
What particular industries do you think would be affected by NAFTA if it were to change?
Well, manufacturing is the industry that would be affected the most. From specific industries, aerospace and automotive would be greatly impacted because those are the industries that Mexico has grown tremendously, and from the input side of it, those are the ones that are being supplied from the United States perspective a great deal.
Interesting. Okay, so automotive and aerospace is in, they have manufacturing plants and workers in Sonora that are bringing parts up here?
The supply chain for those, if you were to see how many times that goes back and forth because of different parts that get some supplied on the Mexican side, some on the U.S. side, that is one of the most integrated supply chains that we have.
So is the counter argument to that, that those jobs, those manufacturing jobs should be here in America? Could that happen?
Well, you know, the fallacy of all of these jobs left the United States and went to Mexico. Some jobs left the United States and went to Mexico. Other jobs were created to fulfill that integrated supply chain. But a lot of those jobs, honestly, were automated, and robotics are taking those jobs. So I think the greatest fallacy of NAFTA is this: all these jobs left and none were replaced. And that's not the case. There was not that net deficit that everybody believes. We want Mexico to be a healthy economy, creating jobs that can be a partner to the United States and really be a great economy.
Well, Margie Eberman, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Margie Eberman is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives for Government Affairs firm Malera Alvarez. She also told me if these renegotiations on trade deals move forward, Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake will be the ones to defend the trade deals. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Phil Latzman.
And Lauren, Maricopa County's efforts to sell Chase Field to private developers has stalled after the prospective buyers pulled out of the deal yesterday.
The potential purchaser, Stadium Real Estate Partners II, had hoped to tear down the 18-year-old ballpark to build a brand new facility in its place. But in a letter to the County Board of Supervisors, a company representative said the stadium's main tenants, the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are the third party in the deal, had been unresponsive and unreasonable.
In the letter, Martin Greenberg says despite numerous requests since the bid was submitted in August, the baseball team had refused to meet with them. He also took issue with the team's request for $187 million in repairs, calling the amount, quote, greatly exaggerated.
The Diamondbacks were not too happy with the letter. In a statement to KJZZ, the team says it was always willing to meet and would have done so if the legitimacy of the buyers was first established.
Earlier this year, longtime Maricopa County Supervisor Andy Kanasik lashed out at the team's request, told the Diamondbacks and their owner to, quote, take your stupid baseball team and get out. Kunasic, who's leaving his post at the end of the year after 19 years on the job, said at the time he meant what he said, just not how he said it. And he joins us now for an update on what happens next. So, Supervisor, what went wrong with this deal?
You know, the county was in a position between an unsolicited offer to purchase and a tenant that had certain rights, and it seemed that, you know, the two of them getting together was the only chance of making something work. And they've had discussions, as far as I know. It appears that they didn't bear any fruit. I think the buyer seems to have just decided to move on, focus their efforts elsewhere.
How difficult is it, Supervisor Kanasik, to negotiate a deal like this when you have a third party involved that certainly has not been in a good relationship with the county trying to sell the team? Has that just complicated things, that acrimony that seems to be sitting there?
You know, the acrimony that people talk about is still a little confusing to me, because I don't believe the county's ever done anything to warrant the behavior and that's been focused on it from the team. I think the county and the team have enjoyed for nearly 20 years a great relationship, and then just out of nowhere, you know, comes this abrupt change. And so there's no hard feelings from my part, and quite frankly, I'm leaving at the end of the year, and it'll, somebody else will, maybe a fresh set of eyes and, you know, a new mind might make some sense of it.
One of the big issues is the amount
that it would cost to repair the stadium. The Diamondbacks are sticking with $187 million. They say that amount is what the county has said it would take. The county says that was just sort of future projections and that it's not something that would be needed now. And even the prospective buyer in the letter said that he thought that that estimate is of $187 million was greatly exaggerated, maybe more like $80 million. Is that the first thing you have to figure out, is what's needed to fix the stadium or get it into the shape that the Diamondbacks want? And has the idea of completely tearing it down and building something else, is this company had proposed, is that still in the picture?
You know, as 2027 comes sooner and sooner, time flies, you know. It's going to be here before you know it.
That's when the lease ends, the last year that the Diamondbacks have to. They are contractually obligated to be here through the 2027 season.
Yeah, and that's it. And I guess, you know, it's indisputable that this community loves baseball, whether it's Cactus League or Major League Sports or Major League Baseball. I think, you know, we all hope that it stays. Maybe Major League Baseball could be brought in and help mediate or somehow repair a relationship that, at least from this half of the relationship, we can't figure out what went wrong.
Andy Kunasik, outgoing Maricopa County Supervisor. Sir, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. From the records of Wyatt Earp's trial after the OK Corral shootout to every record the governor's office makes today, the Arizona State Archives hold a lot of information. And now there's a new state archivist in charge of them. Ted Hale has spent the last decade working in the state library, and he joins me now just a week into his new role. And Ted, I doubt most people know, so tell me, what is it that the state archivist does exactly?
I'm not a certified archivist. I'm not a collections manager. I'm not a conservator. I call myself the four P's. Arizona's the five C's, which is a myth too, but I call myself the four P's. I'm personnel, policies, procedures, and definitely politics, because records can be political. There's no records police. We can't go to the governor's office and say, you know, these are the records that we need from you, and these are the records that all governors have given us. We can only show them in statute what we're asked to collect, and we help them manage those records. I'm the one that puts wheels on what the archivists do, what the records analysts do, because not only are these old records we're talking about, on the other side of the street is the Records Management Center, and we're involved in body-worn camera videos, which is a huge topic.
Right, so you're collecting records all the time today. We're not just talking about history here. Okay.
Absolutely. We obviously can't collect all the emails and electronic-born digital information that's being created in Arizona. So we show people, here's how you archive your emails. Mm-hmm. There's basically four things that we collect: legal, historical, administrative, and fiscal records. And those tell huge stories.
So it seems like part of the job is to kind of keep a record of, like you said, what goes on politically in our political process, good or bad, in the state.
Sure.
So it's almost like a way, historically, especially, to hold the state accountable for parts of its history that we may not want to talk about.
That's true.
Right. So how do you balance that, sort of, when you technically operate under the Secretary of State's office?
Sure.
And you're also sort of documenting those things as you go?
That's a great question. It's all about the record, because whether it's an email or a tweet, Facebook, or a document that's 50 or 60 years old, so we take the political aspect out of it and say that it's the record that folks are after, not the environment in which it was created or the records. We try to get them to speak for themselves.
So you're digitizing the records now. That's sort of a long process, I can imagine.
Yes.
What does that cost? How do you do it?
Oh my gosh, it's very expensive. If we took all of the emails, just imagine the petabytes of server space that would cost. And in our estimation, and I know the Secretary of State feels strongly about this, and I agree, that's not the taxpayer's obligation. So it's a personal goal of mine to try to get this going with private funds, with donated funds, and we are trying to to begin an electronic records repository. As people are coming to us now and they're producing documents that they once used to produce on paper, they're producing them born digital. And by statute, some of these have to come to us as permanent records. So how do we do that? Right now, we're holding about 1.47 terabytes of electronic records. A terabyte of information for everyone's information is about 10,000 books. So we have, about 20,000, about 25,000 books of electronic information, if you will.
Last thing I have for you.
Sure.
So you've said, and I'm going to quote this, more people need to know about what a hidden gem we have in our state archives.
I'll say.
So what records do you think should be more accessible? What do you want people to know about?
I would like to see people use the archive more actively in their own lives. We had someone who came down and said that he found these Christmas cards from his great-grandparents who lived in Phoenix, and they're from Apache Street and Yavapai Street, and they have a downtown zip code, and there is no Yavapai. Well, our old maps from 1907, 1908 show 7th Street, the streets and the avenues downtown used to have Native American names. So that would explain why great-grandfather's Christmas cards came from Apache Street. So there's lots of little connections in people's lives, from genealogy to property values. So records are alive, and they can really serve people.
All right. Well, Ted Hale, the new Arizona State Archivist, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you want to search the state archives, you can see what they have online at azlibrary.gov. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia. But you can get in on the action, too. Just solve this riddle. I'm tall when I'm young, and I'm short when I'm old. What am I? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Since Donald Trump won the presidential election earlier this month, reports have been circulating that calls to suicide hotlines from the LGBT community are up. Some have concerns about Trump's support of the controversial North Carolina law that would restrict transgender people from using the bathroom of their choice, and about Vice President-elect Mike Pence's signature on a religious freedom bill that was largely seen as targeting the LGBT community. And I'm joined by Robert Chevalot to talk about this. He's the president of the Arizona Trans Youth and Parent Organization, a support group for parents and families of transgender kids. Robert, your youngest daughter is transgender. So as a parent, what was your reaction to this election?
You know, surprised like everybody else and a little bit of concern, mostly because there are just so many unknowns. Candidate Trump said a lot of things during the campaign. Nobody really has a good sense as to what is a policy, what is just his opinion, what is he going to follow through on, what was just bluster, what was to, you know, raise support and that sort of thing, and what was, you know, sort of a foundational a negotiating position. So, you know, there's certainly some things that he said in the past that, you know, I would view as being unsupportive of, you know, the transgender population. So everyone's kind of in a wait-and-see kind of mode.
You run a support group, so, you know, what's happening here in our community? What have you heard from your members since this election?
There's definitely a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of fear. I think it's part of it is the unknown. You know, what's Trump, what's Pence going to do? And there's a practical side, too. I mean, we have one member who, she has an 8-year-old daughter who, you know, was just playing at the park. And she's very outspoken. She's very proud of who she is. And she was, you know, being given a hard time by a couple of 12 and 13-year-old boys who were just riding by on her bike and just harassed. And that wouldn't have happened, you know, a week and a half ago. We have other members in our support group who her daughter goes to school in the Northwest and for the first time is kind of afraid to come home. We have another woman whose son is, again, a very outspoken, very strong, very smart, very talented man who now has kind of retracted and said, you know, I really have to kind of keep this under wraps. And again, so it's just a level of anxiety that wasn't there before the election. And, you know, as a parent, looking at your kid kind of retract is, it's very uncomfortable. It's very unsettling. You want nothing but the best for your children. You want them to reach their highest and fullest potential. And so to see a barrier slam down this fast and this quickly is very frustrating.
As a father in this position and as someone who works with other parents, what are you worried about?
Mostly I'm worried that she's not, that there are going to be barriers in her way that that she doesn't even know about yet. You know, I see my job as a parent to sort of act as the CEO for the family. You know, my my job is not necessarily to do everything for her, but it's certainly to knock down the barriers that she face, to build her self-confidence, to build her self-esteem, to give her the tools to be successful so that when she's out there in the real world, she can do whatever she wants to do. And so when you know, when people come along and kind of preempt that a little bit and say, well, you know, you can't do this because you're transgender, or you can't go here, or you can't do this or do that, you know, that's the sort of thing I worry about. You know, if she's robbed of her potential, I see that as being very unfair. And that's what concerns me most, I guess.
Right. So looking forward, with so many unknowns right now, what do you think you can do?
I think right now, with all the unknowns, the biggest thing I can do is remain positive. You got to hope for the best. Nobody knows on either side of the spectrum what's going to happen, where things are going to go. And if things, you know, start to go south, well, I think it's okay to make your voice heard and say, you know what, this isn't fair and this isn't right. Here's why it's unfair. Here's why it's not right. You got to, especially with kids, you got to remain positive, you know. So that's what I try to do.
Robert Chevalot is the president of the Arizona Trans Youth and Parent Organization. And one of the most important things he says transgender families should do now before the new administration takes office is to make sure their gender is updated with the Social Security Administration and on things like passports and driver's licenses.
In the November general election, where we had a female presidential nominee for the first time in history, 42% of women voted for Donald Trump, and a majority of white women voted for Trump. KJZZ's Naomi Gingold joins me to talk more about this. Naomi?
Hi, Steve. I spoke to Dr. Suzanne Dovey. She's a political scientist at the University of Arizona. And she says political scientists often describe Black Americans as voting with a sense of shared fate, and so tend to vote as a majority in one direction or another. Women, though, tend to follow how they parse gender equality.
Very active Republican women see gender inequality as a thing of the past. So instead of, like, why aren't women supporting other women, it's like gender equality has been reached, and so you don't need to support women in order to create other opportunity.
So how do you understand that?
I think there's a gap between when we talk about structural conditions and we give statistics and we paint a picture of what's happening at a macro level. That picture often clashes with people's micro realities. I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, wow, you know, the 60s, they had these consciousness raising where women were constantly talking about their experiences as a way to unify and raise political consciousness about their problems. And I feel like, you know, our generation turns to self-help books. Like, how do I dress differently? Or how do I negotiate my salary differently? And so we tend to individualize instead of see things as ways that women are targeted as women, as opposed to targeted because they're not smart enough or not qualified or want to be mommies. Like, I feel like we have a whole, like, societal, like, background conditions that justify women's unequal positions. I mean, what's relevant for the Hillary example is, you know, if you become a successful woman, I think the perception is you will be judged like a bee.
You mean to be a bossy witch?
Yeah, to be a bossy witch. It's so interesting. Like, the standards we use to evaluate men and women are different. And, you know, what we typically identify as, like, having misogynist treatment of Hillary is, do you spend an undue amount of attention to her clothes or her voice?
It was never like Donald Trump's hair is a reason not to support him. For Hillary, it was like get a headband when she was in charge of the health care reform during her husband's administration. So I feel like there's a kind of micro attention that reflects the stereotype that like how you get power as women is based on what you look like. Often how women break the glass ceiling is by being a wife to a husband who has died or a daughter, you know, to a father who is sort of passing on the legacy. And I think what's interesting is the ways which Clinton's husband both helped and hurt her.
You know, there are places where they've technically had a Democratic vote, or what we call a Democratic vote, like Afghanistan, Iraq, even like India. I mean, lots of places where it seems like women, in a sense, vote against their interests. Like they vote for people who don't believe in equal empowerment. And I'm wondering if what you think about that and if that has anything to teach us about our own experience.
What we found is that it's never just about getting the right people into office. You also need to have a civil society that's putting pressure on elected officials. And you also need to have a bureaucracy that's willing to enact and implement and monitor the policies that are adopted. And so it's when you have these three like women-friendly institutions that you see policies reflecting women's interests. I think what's interesting about the United States is all the recent literature has shown that women actually are better voters in the sense that they vote more often than men. The question is, will our political system actually be responsive?
I mean, if we look at the recent election, though, do we say, well, women are so entrenched in a society that sexual abuse seems like the norm that they're willing to vote for someone who would do that because it just doesn't seem like a big deal? It's what they're used to.
I'm not sure, and I actually would love to see an empirical study about whether or not women believed that Trump was guilty of sexual assault. It's either they believed him and were willing to dismiss it because of other issues, or they didn't believe him. And so you can take two messages. One is that when it came down to it, other issues were more important, or he's been accused of groping and by women, and I just don't believe the women.
That was Dr. Suzanne Dovey, a political scientist at the University of Arizona.
AAA says this Thanksgiving holiday, nearly 50 million Americans will be traveling. And if you're driving on Arizona's Interstate 17 during that time, it might feel like all of them are right there with you. I-17, which connects Phoenix to Flagstaff, is notorious for traffic snarls and closures. KJZZ's Stina Sieg recently traveled north to the common epicenter of the congestion to get locals' takes on these traffic troubles.
Black Canyon City, about 40 miles north of Phoenix, is famous for two things: delicious pie from the local diner and epic traffic congestion. If you're lucky enough to have not experienced that second thing, local TV can fill you in.
People had been sitting here in their cars for more than 3 hours.
There is no estimation of when the freeway will reopen.
Look at that long line of cars.
Black Canyon City is often stuck in the middle of that long line, with few alternate routes and no frontage road to turn to. But locals in this tiny town have a simple way of avoiding the crush of cars.
We don't go north on Fridays, and we don't go south on Sundays.
David Poplinski says the backup is just that predictable. He's sipping a soda at the bar at Rock Springs Cafe, the local haunt that makes the town's famous pie, and becomes a haven to travelers escaping traffic that sometimes stretches for 20 miles. Paintings of cowboys are on the wall, a giant taxidermied polar bear is standing in the corner, and the place is packed with locals, all with their own ideas about how to deal with the traffic.
We always speculate how what kind of money we could make if we had cold beer and hot dogs.
That's Mike Erickson, who's lived here for 10 years and actually does have a more serious plan for the 17. Ideally, he says, a frontage road would be great, or...
I think it'd be nice if you could just, you know, make a change lanes. The northbound lane is blocked. You should be able to go southbound for a couple miles to get around it.
Retired Arizona Highway Patrolman Richard Smith has a popular opinion. Widen the road by at least one lane north of Anthem.
because there's just too much traffic for too little a road.
About 30,000 cars a day in the Black Canyon City area, and more than 50,000 on the weekends, according to the Arizona Department of Transportation. ADOT says that number has been increasing steadily in recent years. But when it comes to the idea of widening the roadway,
the pie isn't big enough.
Meaning the pot of money ADOT has cannot pay for a giant project like this, at least not all at once. Dallas Hammett is the Deputy Director for Transportation and the state engineer. Hammett says every year, ADOT has about $300 million to use in Greater Arizona, which includes I-17. That might sound like a lot, but that money has to pay for both new projects and maintenance. Hammett estimates it would cost more than $100 million to add a lane from Anthem to Cordis Junction.
So it would take multiple years, or we don't do any maintenance of our system for multiple years.
So no upkeep of roads or bridges, which is simply not an option. And besides, Hammett says, it's not really the road that's the problem. It's people.
About 90 to 95% of crashes are behavior.
Maybe you're texting and swerve into another lane. Maybe you're going too fast around a curve. Maybe you're tipsy and don't realize it. The people of Black Canyon City have seen it all.
We had a lady that tried to save a cow that happened to get on the freeway.
Jean Kessel says that ended in the woman's death and, of course, a road closure. Like all the locals I met in town, Kessel says she's never been in a crash in the area. She and her friends know how to navigate I-17, she says. Unlike...
We call them flatlanders out of Phoenix.
Who just don't get how dangerous this road can be. Kessel's hope is that ADOT puts up more warning signs, alerting people to the same thing.
This is a serious situation. Slow down.
Kessel's going to get her wish. ADOT's scheduled to install new electronic warning and speed feedback signs next year. A widening project is a possible long-term goal, but has not yet been planned. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Black Canyon City.
The role of God has been played by a number of actors, most notably George Burns in the series of Oh God movies in the 1970s and 80s, and Morgan Freeman in a lot of others. An actress, though, that's been much harder to come by. Arizona Theater Company's current production of the Broadway hit An Act of God, created by former Daily Show writer David Jabberbaum, features Paige Davis, best known for Trading Spaces on TLC, playing the title role. Recently, I met Davis and the director of the production, four-time Oscar nominee Marsha Mason, on stage at the Herberger Theater Center to talk about portraying and directing God. I started the conversation by asking Mason why it's significant that God is being played by a woman.
Well, I just think because in general, first of all, God is genderless. So he is a she is a he. So, and of course, the individual carries both the female and the male. So I think it's perfect.
We found that we didn't need to change the script hardly at all, except for some pronouns to reflect the fact that it was a woman playing the role. But the script stood the test of time. And the test of changing genders. I've imagined this script with a child doing it. Like, I think of that little, you know, that little black kid, he's kind of more grown up now, and he was like being president, and all those YouTube videos were going around. I'm like, if this kid could memorize it, it'd be the greatest vehicle for him. It'd be so terrific. I've just imagined so many different people in the role, and I'm really happy that David Jabberbaum was willing to open it up like that.
Does it have to be serious and humorous? Does it have to spread everything? Can it be dark comedy? Can it be light comedy? Can it be a blend of all these things?
Oh, there's a massive amount of dark comedy in this play. And I think the seriousness aspects in the play, there are some serious issues and themes that are presented in the play. And I think if they're just presented directly and clearly, you know, God doesn't necessarily have as many opinions about this or guilt about anything that's going on. So anything that is presented by God, I think the more straightforward it is, the more clear people can read into the seriousness of it.
I think also too, the fact that there are serious moral and ethical issues in the play. And I love that Jabberbaum has found a way to deliver it to an audience. And hopefully the idea is you don't have to agree with everything that he is saying in the play. But at the same time, I do think it provokes a conversation.
The entire conceit of the show is that it's
approachable and accessible. The idea that God would come down in the form of a personality you already know and love makes those issues more receivable in and of themselves. So it's built into the conceit of the show.
So whether someone is a traditional churchgoer, temple attendee, whatever, or an atheist or an agnostic, why is it that God, whether nonfiction or fictional character, is so intriguing to so many creative people?
Well, because it's the big issue. You know, it's just the big issue. Is there something beyond us? Does it have a personality? Does it really actually state a right and wrong? It's fascinating when you study other religions. I spent a lot of years investigating other religions, for example, in Hinduism, and they don't carry any guilt. They have separate deities, but they're all representing a basic idea of a super kind of divine consciousness or energy or source or whatever you want to call it. So for me, it's very provocative and interesting. I think people get into trouble when they try to minimize it because it is extremely inclusive. And God, actually, which is what's wonderful about the play, he or she doesn't care, really. It's out there for free will to have its choice. And then, as a human being, you wind up learning your own personal lessons and what sits comfortably for you, what is right for you, what is wrong for you.
So, Paige, have you noticed you're behaving any different at home? Have you?
And we always joke that it's Patrick that has the God complex, but although he is actually the better half in our relationship, I should never say that about him, but I'm only joking. But no, I haven't noticed that I feel more superior in any way. If anything, this show has been insanely humbling. But what I have noticed is I tend to look at things wondering more how God feels. Like, for instance, the gentleman who plays Gabriel in the show, his name is Jimmy Gleason, and we spent a day off going to the Biosphere when we were still down in Tucson. And I couldn't help walking around at the Biosphere and looking at all these things and photosynthesis. And I've had these thoughts before, but they're just so in the front part of my, you know, my cerebral cortex when you're playing God. Like, how much of this is divine?
Now, Marcia, you've directed before, of course, but as I mentioned, you're known as an actress. So what sort of influence do you bring as an actress to what you expect from folks like Paige and everything else when you're directing?
She knows she could do it better.
No, that's not true.
I know.
That's not true. Actually, what is really great as an actor is I try to create a space in which the actors can feel totally safe. So I try to provide for them what I would like, what it means to me to have somebody just support me. I just try to nudge in the right direction, but I don't try to have them do it the way, quote unquote, I would do it. It's much more important for me. Like yesterday, it was so exciting because I hadn't seen the show for several weeks, and I came back, and even though we were kind of marking it and we weren't full out because we were just getting used to the theater and doing new cues, Paige's line readings and everything had become her own. And it was so exciting because it was inside of my head what I had hoped we would get to.
People will always bring up the fact that as women get older, it's harder for them to get good roles. It's harder for them to get many things when it comes to the arts. What are your thoughts on that? Would you have any advice for a younger actress like Paige sort of trying to navigate through that?
You have to hang tough. And also, you have to be prepared. I had a unique experience in that I was just a working sort of beginning New York actor when all of a sudden Destiny just sort of stepped in and I got those films and, Academy Award nominations almost immediately. And I was not really prepared. I was not prepared. I got scared. I didn't know how to make decisions. I went and hid, actually. And then when I was constantly working, it was great, but my identity was wrapped up in it. And then when the work slowed down, I suddenly realized I was having sort of a mini identity crisis. Like, who am I, really, if I'm not working? And so I had to learn that my work is my work and I love it. But it isn't just who I am.
Marcia Mason, director of Arizona Theater Company's current production of An Act of God, and Paige Davis, the star of the show. We spoke on stage at the Herberger Theater Center in downtown Phoenix, which hosts the play through December 4th. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.